That's okay. I'll take the praise.
You could bank on this. And I am good when I do my research.
Mm.
I consider myself the best. I already have a proven track record. The evolution of our solar system before the Earth was formed and all the planets has never, repeat, has never been visited by probes or observations from any, repeat, any extraterrestrial society in the entire universe, or from these baloney theories about multi-universes or fourth-dimensional beings. Never. There has never been a UFO that landed on this planet. No probes, no passbys, nothing. There's no aliens living on this planet.
Okay, all right. I think you get it. I really appreciate the caller confidently putting that to rest. And I know there are people in our audience with different perspectives on this issue, but this call, if you go by his confidence, he must be completely correct. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Sarah Huckabee Sanders says that if she is governor, kids in the womb will be as safe as kids in classrooms. Wait a second. That something about that is not making sense. We will discuss it. We have a study that finds that when a state passes a concealed carry law, gun crime goes up by 33%. And we will also talk about the belief among more than half of Americans that the Supreme Court is coming for gay marriage sooner or later after the Roe v. Wade decision, that the Supreme Court is coming for gay marriage. I happen to agree. And we will talk about that on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You will get instant access to the bonus show.
That is a frickin' predator right there.
Not predatory at all. If you like it, then you keep it. That's how it is. Use the coupon code BIGVOTING22 to sign up at joinpacman.com, get instant access to the bonus show, and then, if all goes well, I will be back here with you tomorrow.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So the plight of migrants seeking refuge is always a humanitarian crisis, but tonight we are dealing with a horrific human tragedy.
At least 46 people have been found dead inside a sweltering tractor trailer abandoned in San Antonio, Texas. 16 survivors, including 4 children, have been hospitalized. We'll speak to Fernando Garcia, founder of the Texas-based Border Network for Human Rights. We'll also look at the ongoing fallout from the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe. Then, is raising money to send pregnant people to another state to get an abortion considered aiding and abetting? We'll speak to the head of an abortion fund in Texas, then look at the fight over privacy rights online in a post-Roe America.
In our joint investigation with The Markup, we found that Facebook is collecting highly sensitive data about the visitors of hundreds of crisis pregnancy center websites across the country, enabling anti-abortion organizations to target and influence people online.
And we look at conservative Justice Clarence Thomas's call for the court to overturn key rulings establishing the right to contraception and taking down same-sex marriage. We'll speak to Jim Obergefell, the lead plaintiff in the Supreme Court case that legalized same-sex marriage throughout the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Texas, at least 46 migrants were found dead inside a sweltering tractor trailer that was left abandoned on a remote road in San Antonio, Texas, Monday. 16 survivors were hospitalized, including 4 children, to be treated for heat stroke and exhaustion as the region faces a scorching heat wave. Local authorities said a city worker heard a cry for help from inside the truck Monday afternoon and found a body on the ground outside the trailer's partially open gate. This is San Antonio's fire chief, Charles Hood.
The patients that we saw were hot to the touch. They were suffering from heat stroke, heat exhaustion, no signs of water in the vehicle. It was a refrigerated tractor trailer, but there was no visible working AC unit on that rig.
This is among the deadliest tragedies in recent decades of people attempting to cross into the United States and comes as the Biden administration continues to enforce harsh border policies blocking most people from safely entering through ports of entry at the U.S.-Mexico border. Thousands are forced to take on extremely dangerous routes and rely on smugglers. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Judges in Louisiana and Utah have temporarily blocked statewide abortion bans from taking effect following Friday's Supreme Court ruling striking down Roe v. Wade. On Monday, a judge in New Orleans sided with reproductive rights groups who argued Louisiana's trigger law ban on abortions was unconstitutionally vague. Meanwhile, a judge in Salt Lake City Monday granted a two-week stay of Utah's trigger law abortion ban after Planned Parenthood sued to block it. In Texas, a Harris County judge hears arguments today in a lawsuit brought by abortion providers who want to block a pre-Roe v. Wade abortion ban from taking effect. The law, which has not been enforced for nearly a half century, criminalizes anyone performing an abortion or assisting in one. In South Dakota, Republican Governor Kristi Noem is calling on lawmakers to pass a bill banning state residents from holding telemedicine appointments with health care providers who prescribe abortion pills and deliver them through the mail. Medication abortions represent half of all U.S. abortions, and demand for the pills has soared since Friday's Supreme Court ruling. In California, state lawmakers on Monday agreed to put a constitutional amendment up for a vote on the November ballot that would enshrine the legal right to an abortion. Los Angeles resident Raquel Rojas joined hundreds of protesters who took to the streets Monday.
We are protesting here for everybody's right to have body autonomy, for the undocumented women, for the black women, for the indigenous women, for the women in domestic, violent domestic partnerships, and women that are going to get pregnant against their will. How is possible that AR-15 has more right in this country than a woman? We are failing our girls if we're not out in the streets.
On Capitol Hill, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Monday she's preparing votes on several bills guaranteeing access to abortion and protecting the data of people who use reproductive health apps. Pelosi also called on her Democratic colleagues to eliminate the filibuster in order to overcome Republican opposition to reproductive rights bills in the Senate. We'll have much more on the battle over abortion rights later in the broadcast. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection has announced a surprise hearing today. Cassidy Hutchinson, former aide to then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, is expected to testify publicly. She was previously interviewed by the committee behind closed doors, where she named a number of Republican lawmakers who inquired about pardons over their efforts to overturn the 2020 election. According to CNN, it was Hutchinson who revealed that Trump supported the mob's chants of "Hang Mike Pence" January 6th, and that Trump had complained about Pence being hustled to safety while Trump supporters breached the Capitol. Elsewhere, former Trump lawyer John Eastman revealed Monday that federal agents seized his cell phone last week as part of a broadening investigation into the insurrection. Meanwhile, Ali Alexander, the founder of the so-called Stop the Steal pro-Trump group, said Monday he testified before a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. last Friday. Alexander is suing the January 6th committee to prevent it from obtaining his phone records. Democracy Now! Is live streaming today's committee hearing at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at democracynow.org. In central Ukraine, a Russian missile struck a crowded shopping mall in the central city of Kremenchuk Monday, killing at least 18 people, injuring dozens. At least 36 others remain missing. One survivor said she was shopping with her husband when the blast threw her into the air.
I flew headfirst and splinters hit my body. The whole place was collapsing. Then I landed on the floor and I don't know if I was conscious or unconscious. I didn't understand anything. I opened my eyes and I saw a big piece of rubble was on top of me. I started to scream, "Help me!" Water was coming from somewhere. The water woke me up.
Elsewhere, Russian shells continued to rain down on the city of Kharkiv, where officials say 5 people were killed, 30 others injured, an elementary school destroyed. In Germany, leaders of the G7 condemned Russia's latest attacks as sickening, cruel, and horrendous, and pledged to support Ukraine's resistance to Russia's invasion, quote, for as long as it takes. G7 leaders concluded their summit with a pledge to spend $5 billion this year to help ensure worldwide food security after Russia's invasion of Ukraine exacerbated a global food crisis. Today, President Biden's traveling to a summit of NATO leaders in Madrid, Spain, where NBC reports he'll announce an extended buildup of troops in Poland and the Baltic countries. Ahead of the summit, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the military alliance would massively increase the number of its forces on high alert from 40,000 to more than seven times that amount.
We will transform the NATO response force and increase the number of our high readiness forces to well over 300,000.
In Jordan, at least 13 people were killed and more than 250 others injured Monday after a cloud of toxic gas burst from a storage tank at the port of Aqaba. The disaster struck after a cable snapped as it lifted a tank filled with 25 tons of toxic chlorine onto a ship. France is calling on Western powers to continue negotiations that would allow Venezuela and Iran to return to the oil market as an attempt to combat the energy crisis and rising prices due to the war in Ukraine. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro responded in a televised address from Caracas Monday.
Yo le diría al presidente Macron.
I would tell President Macron, Venezuela is ready to receive all the French companies that want to come to produce gas and petrol for the European market, for the global market. You are welcome to come whenever. The road is paved. We are prepared, ready, and happy to do it.
This comes as senior U.S. government officials recently secretly traveled to Caracas, Venezuela, in the latest attempt to reestablish ties with the Venezuelan government and release U.S. citizens detained in Venezuela. In Ecuador, indigenous leaders have agreed to meet with government officials to negotiate demands for lower fuel and food prices as massive protests enter a third week. On Sunday, right-wing President Guillermo Lasso promised lower fuel prices to try to quench the anti-government uprising.
Por esto he decidido.
I have decided to reduce the price of gasoline, extra and ethanol blended gasoline, by 10 cents per gallon, and also diesel by 10 cents per gallon. Ecuadorians who seek dialogue will find a government with an outstretched hand. Those who seek chaos, violence, and terrorism will find the full force of the law.
In Missouri, at least three people were killed and dozens more injured Monday after an Amtrak train carrying more than 250 people collided with a dump truck northeast of Kansas City. Investigators say the crash occurred at a railroad crossing that did not have warning lights or protective gates. Here in New York, a state Supreme Court judge in Staten Island has struck down a law that would have allowed some 800,000 non-citizens to vote in local elections in New York City. The measure was set to go into effect in January. Judge Ralph Porzio argued the law violated state constitutional guidelines. California is set to become the first state to grant all undocumented immigrants access to state-subsidized health insurance. Governor Gavin Newsom announced Sunday a budget deal had been struck with California's legislature, including an expansion to the state's Medicare that would expand coverage to hundreds of thousands of low-income undocumented adults between the ages of 26 and 49. California already provided state Medicare to undocumented children, adults under the age of 26 and 50 years and older. In Lisbon, Portugal, the United Nations has kicked off a five-day conference on restoring the health of the world's oceans. Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned global heating is pushing ocean temperatures to record levels, creating fiercer and more frequent storms and pushing sea levels higher. Rob Higgs, a climate activist with the group Extinction Rebellion, joined protests ahead of the talks.
The oceans are empty. We are catching less fish now than we were 30 years ago with all the advances in technology. The seas are dying and we need an appropriate urgency that we're not seeing from our leaders.
And back in the United States, primaries are being held today in five states, including Oklahoma, New York, and Colorado. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today with the horrific story of 46 men, women, and children seeking safety and a better life in the United States found dead Monday night in San Antonio, Texas. A warning to our listeners and viewers, this story contains graphic details. San Antonio authorities say they found 46 migrants dead inside a sweltering tractor trailer that was left abandoned in a remote road on Monday. 16 survivors were hospitalized, including 4 children, to be treated for heat stroke and exhaustion as temperatures in the region surpassed 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Local authorities said a city worker heard a cry for help from inside the truck yesterday afternoon and found a body on the ground outside the trailer and a partially open gate to the trailer. This is San Antonio's fire chief, Charles Hood.
The patients that we saw were hot to the touch. They were suffering from heat stroke, heat exhaustion, no signs of water in the vehicle. It was a refrigerated tractor trailer, but there was no visible working AC unit on that rig.
Authorities said many of the dead had been sprinkled with steak seasoning in a possible attempt by smugglers to ward off law enforcement officials. Fire Chief Hood said the people who helped to rescue the survivors and remove the dead are now being counseled.
We are currently putting those 60 members through critical incident stress debriefing. Again, we're not supposed to open up a truck and see stacks of bodies in there. None of us come to work imagining that. So we're working through the behavioral health for our folks right now.
The staggering death toll is among the deadliest tragedies in recent decades of migrants attempting to enter the United States and comes as the Biden administration continues to enforce harsh border policies, blocking most people from safely entering through ports of entry at the U.S.-Mexico border. Thousands are forced to take on deadly routes and rely on smugglers. This has San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg.
So the plight of migrants seeking refuge is always a humanitarian crisis, but tonight we are dealing with a horrific human tragedy. So I would urge you all to think compassionately and pray for the deceased, the ailing, the families.
3 people have been arrested so far. It's not clear if this is connected. This comes as human rights advocates are calling for the surviving migrants who aid federal investigators to be safe from deportation. We go now to Texas. We're joined by Fernando Garcia, founder and executive director of the El Paso, Texas-based Border Network for Human Rights. Fernando, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, if you can just respond to this horror of what took place in San Antonio yesterday.
Amy and Juan, thanks for having me. Listen, there is no words to describe what is happening right now at the border, especially here in Texas, and what is happening in San Antonio. What we are seeing is an unprecedented situation that is evolving and developing at the border. In our calculations, maybe this year we're going to break all the records of migrants that are dying by crossing the border, while crossing the border. Maybe we're going to be reaching this unprecedented number of more than 1,000 migrants a year. That means 3 migrants per day. I mean, this is not only sad, this is not only extreme, but this is ridiculous. I mean, we need to understand that whatever connections we need to do, one of them, it is precisely the policy of deterrence used by the United States government, but also by the state of Texas, to actually prevent migrants to come to the country legally. I mean, what we are seeing is an effort, a concentrated effort, to actually expel the immigrants, reject them, reject asylum seekers and families to come into the United States legally. So many of these migrants are using ways that they didn't use before. They are going into more isolated places. They are getting involved with these criminal organizations just to come across because they are being rejected when they apply for asylum or refugee status. This is an unprecedented situation.
Well, Fernando, I wanted to ask you, Texas Governor Greg Abbott tweeted about this, that these deaths are on Biden. and he blamed President Biden's and his, quote, open borders policy, as Abbott calls it, for resulting in deaths like this, at the same time that the governor has sent National Guard and Texas Rangers in increased numbers to the border to prevent crossings. Your response?
Listen, federal policy in place for decades already, in recent policies implemented by Trump era in at the border, like Title 42, MPP, and others, are directly responsible of this diversion of migrants going into these other ways of crossing the border without documents because they cannot come legally. But let me tell you this, the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, I mean, he's playing a shameful political game. I mean, he is spending $8 billion a year to deploy state troopers at the border in Texas to actually, he called the National Guard to serve as the line of defense of the invasion, he called it. And also he's building his own border wall. I mean, he's the primary responsible of these migrants going into the deserts and into the mountains in Texas, where they are dying in greater numbers. I mean, this is on his hands. I mean, this is part of the policy of criminalizing immigrants, both at the state level and at the federal level.
And yet here we are years and decades after the big immigration protests of 2006, trying to press for immigration reform, and Congress is no closer to trying to come up with a more comprehensive and humane immigration policy. What's your sense of where we go from here?
Listen, we have high hopes during the beginning of this administration that we probably would have a chance to actually pass immigration reform to fix the system, to bring millions of people out of the shadows, to create pathways for people to come legally into the country, to end all of this human rights crisis happening at the border. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. And the administration, Biden administration also is responsible of unfulfilled promises. I mean, he is keeping Title 42 and MPP as one of the main Trumpist anti-immigrant strategies at the border with no reason. I mean, he's also playing politics with this. I mean, they are moving too slow in terms of the promise of creating a more humane border and passing immigration reform. It didn't happen. I mean, this year didn't happen, and it's not going to happen at least for the rest of the year because we're going to have elections, and immigration has always been a contentious political issue. And at the end of the day, both parties actually throw the hot potato against each other, actually playing games with immigrants while migrants are dying in these numbers. And there's refugee camps at the border, and immigrants in the United States are still exploited with no citizenship and rights. So I think it is, again, shameful that both parties are actually had not only forgotten this issue of immigration reform, but also they continue pushing a narrative that is criminalizing immigrants, calling them rapists, an invasion, et cetera.
The Supreme Court is expected any moment now to hand down a decision on MPP, on the Remain in Mexico policy. And you have people who are in Mexico waiting for up to 2 years now. The U.S. government deporting some, how many, what, 2 million people since March 2020 using Title 42. We also hear Guatemalan authorities saying there's some Guatemalans among the dead. Final comments, Fernando Garcia.
Listen, I wouldn't doubt that in those 46 migrants that died in San Antonio, maybe there was someone there that were expelled under Title 42, or they were waiting on their MPP program. Both programs are meant to deter immigrants from coming to the country legally. They are meant to actually send them back to their country, to dissuade them from looking for a better life in the United States. And if MPP, it is reinforced or re-implemented after the decision of the court, what we're going to see is more people waiting in Mexico for their asylum case or the refugee status case to be resolved, to come to the country between ports of entry, coming in those trucks, also in the middle of the deserts, dying in the canals and the river. So I think this is going to create more migrants dying in more unprecedented numbers. So again, this is the wrong policy. This shouldn't be done. Sometimes shouldn't be done earlier. And it's shameful that we're letting that many people dying in our borders.
Fernando Garcia, thanks so much for being with us, founder and executive director of the El Paso, Texas-based Border Network for Human Rights. Coming up, we'll stay in Texas. Is raising money to send pregnant people to another state to get an abortion considered aiding and abetting? We'll speak with the head of an abortion fund in Texas.
Cuando tú estás conmigo es cuando yo digo que valió la pena todo, todo lo que yo he sufrido. No sé si es un sueño aún o es una realidad, pero cuando estoy contigo es cuando digo que este amor que siento es porque tú lo has merecido. Con decirte, amor, que otra vez he amanecido llorando de felicidad. A tu lado yo siento que estoy viviendo. Nada es como ayer. Abrázame que el tiempo pasa y él nunca
me... Abrázame muy fuerte, hug me tightly, by the late Mexican legend Juan Gabriel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to look at the ongoing fallout from the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and eliminate constitutional protections for abortion. Legal battles are being waged across the United States as reproductive rights advocates attempt to halt or delay statewide abortion bans. On Monday, judges temporarily blocked Louisiana and Utah from implementing bans. Meanwhile, abortion rights advocates have also filed lawsuits across the country, including in Arizona, Kentucky, Idaho, Mississippi, and Texas. Within hours of Friday's ruling, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton threatened to criminally prosecute anyone violating a statewide abortion ban that was passed in the 1920s, a century ago, and never repealed. While the American Civil Liberties Union is suing Paxton, health clinics in Texas have stopped providing abortion. Abortion funds in Texas have also temporarily halted services. We're joined now by Camion Connor, executive director of the Texas Equal Access Fund, the first Black woman to head the fund. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Camion. Can you explain what an abortion fund did before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and what you're doing now?
Yes, thank you so much, Amy and Juan, for having me on. I want to share that there are 10 abortion funds in the state of Texas, and we do a couple of different things. Our abortion fund, the T Fund, helps people pay for their abortions in Texas, which cost anywhere from $500 or more. That is because there's no insurance coverage of abortion in our state. Other abortion funds also do practical or logistical support, basically helping someone travel to wherever they need to go within the state previously or with outside of the state as well. That includes like bus passes, plane tickets, meal vouchers, Ubers from your airport to where you're staying, and hotel stays.
And Kenyon, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the advances in medical treatment such as telemedicine, what legally is going to, what do you foresee happening now if someone in Texas does a telemedicine consultation with a doctor outside of the state in terms of dealing information and consultation on abortion? What would be the legal situation there?
I will share with you that our state has already, through the legislature, made it a criminal act for folks to provide telemedicine for abortion care. So we have tried year after year or every 2 years to fight them on this because it would really support people who need access to abortion, especially medication abortion. But it is not something that folks in our state or physicians in our state are allowed to do when it comes to abortion.
That's physicians in Texas, right? But what if it's a physician in Oklahoma or Arkansas? Or a state that does not ban abortion.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that determining that is still a huge question. We have seen that our attorney general is targeting abortion funds and folks that help folks seek care in other states. So I'm not sure if physicians and clinics in other states would possibly be prosecuted for that type of act. But I know that that is something that folks are seeking clarity on from the judicial system at this time.
I mean, it's amazing to think in the past, people from Mexico came to the United States if they had the means to get an abortion. Now the idea that people would be going from the United States to Mexico or to New Mexico or to Colorado. But are you concerned with your fund about providing money for people to go other places? Are you concerned about the state prosecuting you, Camion?
I'm extremely concerned. I know for a fact for myself that our abortion fund specifically is on the radar of anti-abortion extremists and our conservative elected officials. We have received cease and desist letters about our work, tweets saying that they will target us for felony penalties for continuing our work. Our attorney general basically let folks know the day that Roe fell that DAs, everyone, right now, you can start prosecuting, go right ahead. So we have chosen to pause and seek clarity from the judicial system about what our parameters of work could be. I'm sure you all know that because of Senate Bill 8, we have been primarily helping Texans get abortion care outside of the state of Texas since September 1st. When previously only maybe 30% of our callers had to leave the state, likely because there's a 20-week ban in Texas. But now 90% of the folks that we have been helping have been leaving the state to access care. And that is something that should be protected and people should be able to freely travel to do. But I also want to share that being forced to travel for your health care, specifically abortion, is no way for people to access care. It's harmful. It's dangerous, and it increases the stigma of abortion.
Kanya, we've also heard a lot now about the increasing demand for prescription medication for abortions. How will the Texas ban affect the distribution of prescription medication?
So in December 1st of 2021, Senate Bill 4 went into effect. It arbitrarily bans medication abortion after 49 days gestation, which is 7 weeks. Now, previously, folks in Texas could access abortion care up to 11 weeks with a medication abortion. It also bans mailing of medication abortion drugs and creates medically unnecessary reporting requirements for abortion providers, including that they would have to follow someone's subsequent pregnancies and their pregnancy complications for pregnancies after the abortion that they have with the medication abortion pill. Violation of this state law is a felony for any person who violates any part of the law. So our legislator made it really apparent that they knew banning abortion at 6 weeks in Texas would cause a lot of Texans, presumably Black and Brown Indigenous folks, to have to seek medication abortion or self-managed abortion. So they passed Senate Bill 4 to make it harder for folks to do that, and especially make it a felony offense for them to receive these kind of medications through the mail.
I mean, it might surprise people to know that half the abortions in the United States are medication abortions. We're going to talk more about these abortions by this pill regimen later in the week. But both the head of HHS, Javier Becerra, as well as the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, have reaffirmed that they have been approved by the FDA and they are legal. Cami and Connor, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Executive Director of the Texas Equal Access Fund, the T Fund, the first African-American woman to head the T Fund. As states move to criminalize abortion, we're going to look now at growing calls to protect online privacy. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As fears grow that authorities could use online data to prosecute people who violate statewide abortion bans, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has warned, quote, those seeking, offering, or facilitating abortion access must now assume that any data they provide online or offline could be sought by law enforcement. This comes as reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting has exposed how Facebook is collecting ultra-sensitive personal data about abortion seekers and enabling anti-abortion organizations to use that data as a tool to target and influence people online. We're going to go first to Grace Oldham. Grace Oldham is a Howard Fellow for Reveal, where her recent investigation is headlined, Facebook and Anti-Abortion Clinics are Collecting Highly Sensitive Info on Would-Be Patients. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Grace. So lay this out for us. Talk about everything from period trackers, you know, menstrual period trackers, to what people say and look for online and how it can be used against them.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. So, as laws are changing now across the country, there are increased warnings about the risks of how people's data online could be used against them if abortion is criminalized in their state. And so in our investigation, we were specifically looking at crisis pregnancy centers. We've been investigating crisis pregnancy centers at Reveal for months now, and they're quasi-health clinics that are run by anti-abortion organizations with the main goal to deter or delay people from getting an abortion. And because they're not licensed medical facilities, the data they collect on people they interact with either online or in person isn't protected in the same way other health data might be. And so, we were curious what's happening to that data and how might it be used, again, you know, as laws are changing across the country. So we started looking at what type of ad tracking technology these websites, these organizations use on their websites, and found that hundreds of crisis pregnancy websites across the country use an ad tracking technology that shares information with Facebook. And as you said, it's ultra-sensitive data. In many cases, it includes information as specific as whether the person is considering an abortion, their pregnancy status, if they were scheduling an abortion consultation, and even in some cases, names, emails, and phone numbers. Of course, this poses a particular risk if an abortion is criminalized or outlawed in states. And it gives key indications about whether a person is considering an abortion, and amassing that on a platform like Facebook creates particular avenues for law enforcement to potentially use that information. And so, this is one among many potential risks created by data that is amassed online.
But Grace, these crisis pregnancy centers, if they're collecting basically a person's individual medical information, even if they're not licensed, aren't they covered by HIPAA laws in terms of being able to divulge to others personal data on individuals?
Yeah. So actually, these most crisis pregnancy centers are not covered by HIPAA, and that's because they're not licensed medical facilities and they do not charge for their services. So because they're not covered by HIPAA, that data is not protected in the same way that, you know, it might be if it was through a hospital or something like that. And so, you know, that was one of our main questions in starting this reporting is, okay, if they're collecting really sensitive data about people, you know, online in forums asking questions like when was the date of a person's last menstrual period, or in person, you know, ultrasound photos, the results of pregnancy tests. And so, you know, we had started really researching what happens to that data once it's collected by these centers.
But wouldn't it be possible to at least require them to disclose to the people that are giving information that they are not licensed and that the information they're giving is not can be shared with others? Isn't there a disclosure requirement at least, or shouldn't there be one?
Yes, in some cases, crisis pregnancy centers do mark on their websites when they are not licensed, but often that's tucked away into deep into a privacy policy where, you know, a person not doing like an extensive dive into the website would find it. There was also a Supreme Court case several years ago that overturned a requirement in California for crisis pregnancy centers to state whether they are medical facilities. And so, you know, they're positioned now more than ever to, you know, make that, not have that be as clear as, you know, some consumer protection.
And Grace, it's reported around the country that they'll often locate themselves next to, for example, a Planned Parenthood clinic and look like that clinic. So people get confused and not exactly clear where they're walking in. But I wanted to ask you about Meta, right, the new name for Facebook. What measures are they taking for protecting privacy? Did they speak to you?
Right. So, you know, Meta has policies against collecting sensitive data, specifically including sexual and reproductive health data. And in the past several years, there's been reporting and a state investigation which found that, you know, their advertising systems is essentially, you know, quite porous about around the vast information that's collected by Meta every day on websites across the country. And so, you know, we found that in the case of these crisis pregnancy centers, hundreds of them are sharing this information with Facebook, and Facebook is ingesting that data. In response to a New York State Department of Financial Services investigation, Facebook created filtering mechanisms with several thousand key terms. I think it's something like 70,000 key terms that are supposed to block anything that would be considered sensitive data. Although, you know, and URLs that we found with, you know, pregnancy or abortion in them, data was still collected from those sites. So we sent a list of questions to Facebook, specifically questions around their policies around data collected from crisis pregnancy centers and whether that data would be shared with law enforcement. And we did not get a response to those questions. And we have not seen change since the publish of our story in terms of if the data of the sites that we identified has been purged.
Grace Oldham, I wanted to bring Daley Barnett into this conversation, a staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which recently published a set of digital privacy guidelines for abortion providers and abortion seekers on how to protect their information. We're going to break and then come back to this conversation. We're speaking with Daley Barnett and Grace Oldham. Stay with us. Men Explain Things to Me by Taco Cat. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue our conversation around Facebook, anti-abortion clinics collecting highly sensitive information on would-be patients, that investigation is done by Grace Oldham, a reproductive rights reporter with Reveal. We are also joined by Daley Barnett, a staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who just published a set of digital privacy guidelines and guides for abortion providers and abortion seekers on how to protect their information. Daley, thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you walk us through some of these key measures that you think are key for people to protect their information and where you think we're all more vulnerable?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I would say that the first step that abortion seekers, providers, abortion access activists ought to do is an exercise that we call threat modeling. Essentially, threat modeling just means identifying for themselves what pieces of information or data could potentially be used against them and who might want to exploit that data. Asking themselves these types of questions helps to identify the areas of concern they might have, and then from there, the types of measures that can be taken to protect themselves. From there, I think it's important to employ a combination of non-technical and technical tactics, starting with the non-technical, because those are usually a bit easier. I think people can set some data sharing standards with their communities. This means essentially making some rules about what types of information can and cannot be shared with the group or outside the group, et cetera. Basically, it's just pushing a culture of consent when it comes to sharing any kinds of identifying information about reproductive health or activism or affiliation with other groups. People can also employ what we call linguistic steganography, which is just some fancy phrasing for essentially hiding true meaning in plain sight or in inconspicuous language. If it's done very consciously and carefully, it can be really effective in protecting oneself and one's community. But then from there, the more technical measures people can take are, first, I would say download an end-to-end encrypted messaging app like Signal, turn on disappearing messages, super important. Also, just generally, I think it's important that people compartmentalize the data around the more sensitive operations like reproductive health or activism away from the more casual ones. So this can be done by using a separate browser with hardened privacy, we call it. So like a browser like Tor or Brave that are built with privacy and security in mind, and using that especially for anything related to their reproductive health or their activism. I also highly recommend turning off location services on apps that don't need it or restricting them when you're going to or from locations where that's, you know, a concern. Turning off the ad identifier on their phones so that the apps can't track their behavior from app to app to app. And there's a bunch of other things people can do, but I would just recommend going to look at EFF.org for the guides that we have written.
And Daley, what are some of the responsibilities of the technology companies in regard to this? So, because clearly, not just Facebook, but for instance, with Google, the searches that people conduct on a daily basis and that Google stores, have there been any laws about particularly health-related or personal health-related matters, searches that can be somehow or other protected in a stronger way from tracking than normal searches?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm not a policy expert, but I am a technologist, so I'm happy to comment on what these technologies can do to protect the end users. I mean, the reality is that these platforms are the most popular or the largest platforms that exist, right? Like the big ones. And they need to come to terms with the fact that they're holding on to the largest and most potentially dangerous sets of data that can be used against people here. So these platforms need to make their policies transparent to end users now, especially their policies or in regards to how they respond to law enforcement and how they're responding to subpoena requests. They could also stop behavioral tracking on their platforms, because that behavioral tracking amounts to data that could be exploited and used against users. Just generally, they need to honor the privacy of every end user by default. It should not be something that users have to advocate for themselves. They can allow pseudonymous access to their services. Just generally speaking, if the data isn't being collected on end users there, it can't be exploited.
If you could talk more in lay terms about behavioral tracking.
Of course. So behavioral tracking, these are mechanisms that platforms will put in place to uniquely identify users on their services and then track the behavior of like what they're doing on these platforms, right? So this can look like how long they've been on the site, what they're doing there, the types of services or queries they're making on the platforms. And then that data can be collected, and because it's tied to a unique fingerprint to a user, it can then be associated with other behavioral tracking on different platforms. So for instance, Google is the most prevalent tracker in the game, where they have trackers implanted on 75% of the top 1 million websites today.
And in terms of what people can do, and we also want to put this question to Grace Oldham, tell us about the My Body, My Data Act.
Sure. So the My Body, My Data Act is a bill that has been proposed to protect people's data around their reproductive health. It protects the end users. So it restricts the type of data that can be collected by the services that have anything to do with this field, right? But it also allows users to meaningfully appeal to have their data deleted at their request.
And Grace Oldham, if you can talk about your work in how people are organizing around the country and how people can protect themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in the terms of our investigation, you know, Facebook, you mentioned Google has prevalent ad trackers. Facebook is also a big player in the game. And so, you know, we found that Facebook received nearly 60,000 government requests for data from July to December 2021. And so, you know, creating public pressure and legislation for Facebook to answer, you know, how data from crisis pregnancy centers would be used, for example, is one way. Many of the privacy experts that we talked to said that this would be a public pressure or policy issue, because Facebook's revenue comes from advertising, so there's little incentive to fix this on their own, although strengthening the current filters and that they have in place, as well as, you know, evaluating potential risk of this data being collected would be important as well.
And I'm wondering, Daley, what legislation should we be focusing on and should the public be focusing on in terms of digital privacy laws?
I think any privacy legislation that is a broad privacy protection for all end users, it shouldn't necessarily always be focused on specific areas of concern that are, you know, timely. Privacy should just be a default for people. It shouldn't be something that the end users have to fight for, because, you know, especially when that data is potentially dangerous, that could be used as criminal evidence. The reality is that if these companies aren't collecting this personally identifiable data that can be exploited, the problem is solved in all of these cases. Privacy should not be an opt-in model or something that users have to advocate for themselves. It should just be on by default.
I wanted to ask Grace Oldham about some other research you had done. You were just recently in Dallas, in Texas, talking to a Unitarian church that was involved with helping people access abortion. Can you talk about what they're doing and what's happened now that Roe has been overturned and the history of their work?
Yes, absolutely. So I went to Dallas, which is where I'm from, and went to the First Unitarian Church of Dallas, which is actually the church that my family grew up in as well, and had the opportunity to see some of the action happening at that church around helping people access abortion in New Mexico. So there's a long history there. In the 60s, the Unitarian Universalist Church stated their public support for access to abortion. This is before Roe v. Wade. And the ministers at that church were working with the Clergy Consultation Service, which was a network of mostly Protestant ministers and Jewish rabbis across the country who helped people find safe abortions. And so they were working with a doctor named Dr. Curtis Boyd, who we talked about in this radio story that we published this weekend, who was performing safe abortions before they were legal in Texas. And eventually Dr. Boyd moved from Texas to New Mexico, and the ministers at the church at the time helped coordinate flights from Dallas to New Mexico for people to access abortion pre-Roe. Well, now since SB 8 in Texas in September, again, the ministers of the First Unitarian Church and a network of volunteers with the New Mexico Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, as well as Dr. Boyd, who still owns clinics in Dallas and New Mexico in Albuquerque, are making trips every few weeks to Albuquerque to bring a group of around 20 patients to access safe and legal abortions in Albuquerque. And so the church will continue to support people who are needing access to abortion despite how the laws change, and are currently working to figure out like what the parameters around that will be. But yep, there are flights every 2 weeks, bringing 20 patients, organized by a network of volunteers. The funding and the logistics are taken care of by the New Mexico Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice.
And Grace, I wanted to ask you about something we discussed earlier, these crisis pregnancy centers. And you said that there are hundreds of them around the country. Who funds them? Because even if they're volunteers largely that work in them, obviously the rents have to be paid, the organization, the network has to be sustained. Did your research delve at all into how these centers came to be established?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of the funding is from private funders. There's large anti-abortion organization networks of crisis pregnancy centers, such as Heartbeat International, for example. In some cases, the funding comes from taxpayer dollars, public funding from states who fund alternative to abortion programs. And then in some cases, the funding comes from funding diverted from federal funding as well. So the majority is from private donors, but there is some public funding and taxpayer dollars going toward crisis pregnancy centers as well.
Crisis pregnancy centers known as CPCs, and we'll certainly be doing more on them. Grace Oldham, thanks so much for being with us, a fellow at Reveal. We're going to link to your recent investigation, headlined Facebook and Anti-Abortion Clinics Are Collecting Highly Sensitive Info on Would-Be Patients. And thanks to Daley Barnett, staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has just published a set of digital privacy guides for abortion providers and abortion seekers on how to protect their information. We'll link to those as well. And just a reminder, it's primary day in New York, Colorado, Illinois, Maryland, Oklahoma, and Utah. Here in New York, Kathy Hochul is facing two challengers in the Democratic gubernatorial primary, New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams and Congressmember Tom Suozzi. Hochul became governor after Andrew Cuomo resigned last year. We'll report on the results tomorrow across the country. Today at 1 p.m. Eastern, we will live stream the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection with its surprise hearing. That's 1 p.m. Eastern at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
RCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Oh, I'm yours.
I'm yours.
And you're mine.
You're mine.
You are mine.
You're mine.
Baby, I'm yours.
I'm
and
yours.
Nothing's gonna ever come between. Arms around you, whenever you are near, there's a heaven on earth right here. I'm yours,
I'm yours.
You are
mine,
you are mine,
you're mine,
and I'm yours.
I'm yours.
Nothing's gonna ever, no,
ever,
no, baby,
ever
come between.
Keep your